Chapter 9, The S in Hearts, Secure Attachment with Self. It is tremendously important to have relationships with partners where you are able to put into practice the heart of being polysecure. Being seen, understood, appreciated, and loved by another who is turning towards you with their presence and warmth is invaluable in its potential to offer the corrective attachment experiences that so many of us need. But healing attachment does not stop there, and sometimes it doesn't begin there either. While I will not diminish the power that secure relationships with others have to heal our past and to bring alive our own secure ways, the establishment of a secure relationship with ourself is needed to fully embody healthy attachment with others, so much so that it requires its own chapter. When we have experienced attachment insecurity with caregivers, whether in childhood or in adult relationships, or as disruptions in any of the levels discussed in the nested model of attachment and trauma, our primary relationship with ourself can become severed, and the development of certain capacities and skills can become compromised. Attachment ruptures and trauma can also leave lasting marks on our psyche, distorting our sense of self through the beliefs that we do not matter, that we are flawed, broken, unworthy, or too much while simultaneously not enough. This is what needs to be repaired, and in many ways, it is the only aspect of our healing that we are truly in control of, since the heart of being polysecure requires partners to participate with, and the other levels require group or collective-based processes that typically go beyond the individual level. Internal attachment healing is needed for the heart of secure functioning to become possible and then take root in our relationships. Even in the most remarkably secure relationships, being together forever is not a given. Your lives might still take you in different directions, partners can die, and even when partners are actively involved with you, it is unrealistic to expect them to be there for you every time you are in need. When we are relating from attachment insecurity, we can easily and often unconsciously put too much onto our partners. We can make our partners into the source of our hope, love, strength, ability to feel or regulate our own emotions, as well as the source of our meaning and purpose in life. Our partners can be the inspiration for these things, as well as the object or focus of our love, but they should not be the source of it. You are the source of your happiness, love, courage, emotional regulation, and purpose. And the sooner that you can release your partner from being the source of these experiences, the better for everyone involved, metamors included. Knowing how to stand securely on your own two feet and how to be your own safe haven and secure base, it's fundamental to building your internal secure attachment. I would say this to anyone practicing monogamy, but it is even more imperative in non-monogamous relationships. In polyamory, we need the internal security of being anchored in our inner strength and inner nurturer to navigate a relationship structure that is considerably less secure. Inner security is also imperative because depending on a certain partner as our only go-to support system regarding our relationship with another partner, a shared partner or one of their partners can be triangulating, messy, inappropriate, divisive, and even damaging. You must be a priority in your own life. Secure attachment with yourself means being aware of your feelings and desires, as well as being able to tend to your own needs and knowing how to advocate for them in relationships. In the absence of this, your relationships can be built upon a false premise, or at the very least, will struggle to be sustainable. Earn secure attachment. Those of us who did not experience a securely attached childhood, or who have had significant attachment insecurity from our adult relationships, can still develop earned secure attachment. Meaningful contact with teachers, friends, lovers, mentors, therapists, or other relatives who can empathically resonate and securely bond with us can all assist us in adjusting our attachment style towards becoming more secure. At the self level, one way to develop earned secure attachment is through making sense of your story. According to Daniel Siegel, we can make sense of our attachment history by creating a coherent narrative of our past experiences. We do this by putting together the story of what we went through as a child and examining how our attachment history impacts our present sense of self and our relationships today. By telling the stories that have been previously unspoken, we allow ourselves to feel what has been unfelt and bring love to what has seemed unlovable. When we are able to describe our painful past experiences and craft them into a narrative that makes sense to us, healing occurs and our brains can literally be rewired for more secure functioning. Daniel Siegel's research has also shown that the main predictor of a child's attachment style is not whether or not their parent had an insecure or secure attachment style, but whether or not their parents were able to make sense of their own attachment history. When parents had trauma and attachment insecurity, but were able to create a coherent narrative of what they went through, they were then able to break the cycle of attachment insecurity that can easily get passed down from one generation to the next, and instead parent their own child from an earned, secure stance. As adults, when we experience relationship traumas, painful breakups, or losses, creating a coherent narrative about what happened is just as indispensable for our healing and integration. Non-monogamy can feature certain kinds of loss and breakups that don't happen anywhere else in our culture. In discussing why or how a relationship ended, we may not have the same common language that is used in describing monogamous endings, or encounter the same level of acceptance and understanding from others. You may have more partners who could support you post-breakup, and many people definitely benefit from this. But I also see people who feel even more isolated and alone when their non-monogamous relationship ends. Current partners may get tired of hearing about pain or drama from the relationship that ended, for instance, or it may be inappropriate to process the breakup with current partners. Perhaps they are involved with the partner you broke up with still. You also may simply not have relationships that you would turn to for this kind of emotional support. The loss of relationships with metamors or entire polycules that result from a breakup can also be confusing, disorienting, and painful beyond measure. All of this can leave people feeling as if they are floating in outer space with no sense of what's up and what's down, nothing to ground them and help them move forward. In such cases, finding coherence in your story can be a profound support. When crafting the stories of your insecurely attached past, it is important not only to be able to describe and allow the feelings associated with what you've gone through, but also develop an appreciation for the attachment survival adaptations that you took on. Our attachment styles are a result of our response to how available connection was to us. When connection is unavailable, inconsistent, intrusive, dangerous, or out of reach, the attachment system will either start to hyperactivate or deactivate as a survival strategy. Your attachment adaptations are what work best in the environment that you were embedded in, and it is important to recognize the power and wisdom in the different styles that you constructed. As we give voice to our past, accept and allow our pain and even appreciate the ways we were shaped from this, we can be better able to take responsibility for the ways that we still need to grow and show up differently for ourselves and in our relationships. We no longer have to be victims of our past, but we can be victorious in the face of it. Go heart yourself. The heart of secure functioning is not just for your relationships with partners, but can be directly applied to your relationship with yourself. H, being here with myself. In order to create internal security, we must first inhabit our own being. We must fully occupy our bodies, which are the storehouse of our feelings, needs, pains, desires, and longings. When there has been attachment insecurity or trauma, being in your body may not be safe or easy, especially when habits of defensiveness, dissociation, or disconnection have been at play for years or decades. Traumas can limit our ability for presence. When we detach from ourselves, whether through pulling in too far into ourselves or jumping too far out of ourselves into another, we lose access to our own internal states and therefore our own internal resources. We are not truly here in the moment, whether with ourselves or another. Being our own safe haven and secure base requires that we first have the capacity to be with ourselves. To sit, to listen, to be available to whatever arises within us. Life occurs in the present moment, and our healing needs the fullness of our attention in the here and now to take place. Through embodiment, we can learn how to tolerate the uncomfortable feelings and sensations that might be necessary to move through in order to heal. We can also learn to allow positive sensations and feelings that might have been previously exiled. Here are some questions to consider for being here with yourself. In general, how comfortable or uncomfortable do you feel being alone with yourself? What are the subtle and overt ways that you avoid being present with yourself? What does being present with yourself mean to you? How would it look? What does being more embodied mean to you? How would that look? If you were more present and embodied, what possibilities in your life or relationships could open up? Here are some things to try and experiment with. Mindful techniques and meditation practices. Body awareness practices, such as yoga, dance, walking meditation, or body scan meditations. Breath work. Emotional or energetic grounding techniques. Working with a somatic practitioner or body-based psychotherapist. Taking a walk or drive without making calls or listening to anything. Sitting with yourself quietly and allowing yourself to be with whatever arises. Singing or chanting when you're by yourself without worrying how you sound. E, express delight for myself. When applying the attachment need of express delight to yourself, we are talking about an inner sense of joy, appreciation, and pleasure in your own being and existence. As children, it is through mirroring, reflection, and the expressed delight from our attachment figures that we are able to develop a positive sense of self and learn what we are capable of. As adults, we still need this and will typically get this through our closest relationships. When another is able to mirror us and take delight in who we are, we can get to know ourselves even more than we did before. But as adults, our positive sense of self cannot be solely contingent on the expressed delight of those around us. We need to cultivate expressed delight for ourselves in order to maintain a positive sense of worth and healthy appreciation for who and how we are that is sustainable and resilient. Imagine making a mistake, and your response to yourself is one of understanding and forgiveness. Imagine looking in the mirror and having thoughts of acceptance and self-compassion. Imagine looking forward to having some solo time because you enjoy time with yourself and are even pleasantly entertained with who you are. So for those of you having flashbacks of the Saturday Night Live comedy skit where the character Stuart Smalley looks adoringly in the mirror at himself as he says, "I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me." Don't worry. I won't suggest looking in the mirror as you say positive affirmations to yourself. I am talking about the importance of positive self-talk and being kind and loving to yourself in ways that you would probably treat a friend, but so frequently forget when it comes to your relationship with yourself. When we have experienced trauma and attachment ruptures, we can forget what it means to be kind to ourselves. Even a small shift in the way you talk to yourself has significant physical and mental health benefits that can influence your ability to regulate your feelings, thoughts, and behaviors under stress. Positive self-talk is not about placating yourself, trying to falsely boost your ego, or being self-delusional. It is about having an inner dialogue that is forgiving, understanding, flexible, and holds a larger, often more realistic perspective than the negative, defeated, or abusive self-talk that we often tolerate as the inner status quo. Express delight for yourself would mean being able to see your strengths, positive attributes, qualities, and ways of being that you can be proud of and grateful for, as well as seeing where there is still room for self-improvement. When we delight in our children or our partners, we don't necessarily see them as perfect. In fact, we usually see them with all their amazing, difficult, and quirky qualities and choose to take delight in their fullness, contradictions and all. So can you do this for yourself? I see the inner critic and shame as the largest obstacles to rewiring our inner narratives to reflect more self-expressed delight. Trauma and insecure attachment give birth to our inner critic and shame. And just as positive self-talk has health benefits, negative self-talk can have far-reaching negative impacts on our health and can actually activate our threat system, spiraling us into fight, flight, freeze, appease responses, just from our own thinking. It is difficult to embody self-worth when we have parts of ourselves that incessantly beat us up for what we've done, what we haven't done, or how we look. The inner critic is the voice in our head that is harsh, mean, critical, unsympathetic, punishing, shaming, and shoulding. Shame is the part of us that feels beat up by the inner critic, accepting what it says as true, and believing that we are unworthy, not enough, too much, fundamentally broken, and maybe even better off dead. Shame researcher Brené Brown makes the important distinction between guilt and shame, with guilt being the perspective that I've done something wrong, which can be helpful and motivating, and shame the perspective that I am wrong, which can be debilitating and paralyzing. When we have critical or perfectionistic parts of ourselves that spew inner negativity and then shameful parts that absorb these thoughts as gospel, finding love and happiness in ourselves can feel nearly impossible. I've come to see our inner critic as a form of emotional autoimmunity. When someone has an autoimmune condition, the immune system goes into overdrive and the body starts attacking itself instead of protecting itself from outside invasion. When we inquire into the motivation of the inner critic, it is usually a part of us that wants to protect us, keep us safe, or have us be successful, but its methods are actually self-harming and counterproductive to its protective intention. Shame is like a weakened immune system that will catch an emotional cold through even the smallest of insults, neutral feedback, or questioning from another. Even though the part of us experiencing shame often feels powerless, it is quite powerful in its capacity to eclipse our ability to connect with ourselves and with others. Shame can function like a form of deflated narcissism, where any and all phenomena in the world are taken as evidence for how you are not worthy, or how you are fundamentally failing, flawed, or broken. Both the inner critic and shame can sabotage our relationships, because when we are living from these parts, we are usually unable to relate authentically or take responsibility for our actions. But remember that we are more than these parts. The inner critical and shameful parts of us can have a prominent impact through the ways they shape and distort our view of self, other, and the world. And when in the driver's seat, these parts can create much havoc, but they are not the totality of who we are. Just as our attachment styles are not the fullness of who we are, these parts are also just an aspect of ourselves that can be healed and transformed. Therapeutic modalities such as compassion-focused therapy, narrative therapy, and internal family systems use techniques to externalize and engage in dialogue with these parts to gain a better understanding of the ways in which they are either trying to protect us or are still holding pain, traumas, and emotional burdens that can be released. When doing this kind of inner work, the grip that these parts have on us begins to loosen, and more expressed delight can begin to shine through. As problematic parts get revised, unburdened, updated, or transformed, other parts of ourself that have been disowned or exiled, such as our self-esteem, voice, joy, enthusiasm, creativity, or sexuality, can also be reclaimed and integrated, thus fortifying our ability to better enact the strategies and positive self-talk that encourages self-interest, excitement, play, and self-delight. It is just as important to cultivate the parts of us that have self-compassion and help us function in securely attached ways as it is to work with our critical and shameful parts. And I will touch on this in the next section. Here are some questions for you to consider around self-expressed delight. What does expressed delight look like for you right now? How could you increase your self-expressed delight? Do you struggle with critical and shameful inner parts that sabotage your ability to value and appreciate yourself? What would become more possible for you in regard to yourself and your relationships if expressed delight was more central to your inner experience? Now, here are some things to potentially try and experiment with. Take yourself on a date or pamper yourself with something that you genuinely enjoy. Listen to self-hypnosis tracks or positive affirmations that are aligned with what you want to feel about yourself. Write yourself a love letter or make a list of all the things you appreciate about yourself and who you are. Start a gratitude practice and make sure to include yourself as the object of gratitude. Start working with your inner critic and shame through modalities such as internal family systems, narrative therapy, or compassion-focused therapy, which focuses on inner parts work. Check out some resources like Rick Hansen's Hardwiring Happiness or Joe Dispenza's Becoming Supernatural, which both focus on how to create positive changes within your inner landscape. Start to identify the parts of you that do function in secure ways and focus on how to make them more prominent in your life. What daily practices or perspectives can you take on that bring your preferred expression of self more to the front and center of your life? Let yourself laugh and seek out humor. A, attuning to yourself. Attunement is at the heart of secure attachment. In its absence, attachment security ceases to be possible. When there are early childhood attachment ruptures, requisite developments in a person's ability to tune into themselves and regulate their inner states can become hindered. When our childhood needs are not met from the outside and our attachment figures are unable to help us learn how to identify and label our inner experiences in order to make sense of them and soothe ourselves, as adults, we can struggle with knowing how to feel our own feelings, identify our own needs, and calm down our own body, mind, and heart in the way a nurturing caretaker would have. We can also run into considerable relational difficulty when we continue to have an outside-in approach to getting our needs met, expecting that our partners act as a substitute for our own inner nurturer. When we are able to tune in and tend to our own needs from the inside first, we may still seek outward support, comfort, and guidance from our partners. But our fundamental well-being and sense of being okay are not dependent on it. When applied to the self, attunement is our ability to turn inward in order to become receptive and aware of our interior world. Self-attunement is the inner inquiry into what you are feeling, needing, thinking, and experiencing. Self-attunement facilitates self-knowing, which furthers our ability to self-regulate and soothe our own physiological and emotional states, as well as respond appropriately to our environment. Regardless of a person's specific attachment style, people with attachment insecurity will all struggle to some degree with emotional regulation and self-soothing. People with more attachment anxiety tend to seek outward regulation from others. They want to be taken care of, try to overprocess with partners, look for someone to fix or take away what they're going through, or even seek someone else to just tell them what to do. People with an anxious attachment style can struggle with being able to hold and sit with their own feelings. And so, like a game of emotional hot potato, they try to pass off their emotions to their partners in order to diffuse their own discomfort. Seeking this external regulation from others is often at the exclusion of their own self-regulation and their own sense of self. People functioning from a dismissive attachment style steer clear of trying to emotionally regulate with others, because in many ways they don't even see it as a possibility. The co-regulation that a child needs and would experience with an attachment figure was not available to them, so they learn to take care of themselves by disengaging from others and taking space to regulate. From the outside, it may look like people with an avoidant attachment are able to self-regulate well since they are comfortable on their own. But usually they are not actually self-attuning and self-soothing as much as they are auto-regulating, that is, partaking in activities that are more about zoning out or tuning out in order to dissociate from their internal states than tuning into and intentionally working with their internal states. So Table 9.1 shows you the types of regulation which are adapted from Stan Tatkin's The Four Regulation Strategies from We Do, Saying Yes to a Relationship of Depth, True Connection, and Enduring Love. So the types of regulation: auto-regulation, it just happens. Self-stimulation or self-soothing done more automatically than consciously. Auto-regulation is done alone, so there is no interpersonal stress. Can be similar to over-focusing on an object or task and can be dissociative or zoning out. Some examples of auto-regulation could be thumb-sucking, averting eye contact, reading, doing art, watching TV, alcohol, drugs, masturbating, daydream, overeating, swiping or scrolling on your phone. And as I'll say below, not all of those are necessarily negative. External regulation. You do it. Reaching for another to help regulate and soothe you, interactive, but only focusing on one person attuning to the other at a time. Can over-focus on either the self or on the other. Some examples of external regulation are being held and soothed by a caregiver, talking with a friend about your problems, listening to live music or a live talk, getting a massage. Interactive regulation. We do it. Mutual or co-regulation with another where both people are regulating each other. Skin to skin and eye to eye contact. Both people are attuning to each other. Some examples of interactive regulation can be dancing with a partner, having sex, having a mutual dialogue, musicians playing together, or cooking together. Self-regulation. I do it. Regulating one's own state through active or intentional techniques that are self-soothing or stimulating. Ability to exhibit self-control through managing bodily or emotional impulses. Some examples of self-regulation are calming down through breath control, mental techniques like reframing, muscle relaxation, vocal control. Some of the auto-regulation behaviors that I mentioned can also be examples of healthy self-regulation when they are intentional. People with a preoccupied style learn that in order to survive, they need to be vigilant about reaching out towards others, often at the expense of losing their sense of self. Whereas people with dismissive or fearful avoidant attachment styles learn the danger or futility of reaching out to others. And so in retreating into themselves, they lose their sense of other. In my practice, I see that regardless of a person's starting point, all of those with insecure attachment styles need support with knowing themselves better. People with insecure attachment need guidance in connecting more with their authentic needs, preferences, and desires, instead of defaulting into their more reflexive, insecure defense mechanisms. Just as we need techniques that support us in quieting down and transforming our inner critic, we also need strategies that enhance our inner nurturer. Even when we haven't experienced nurturing from others, we still have an innate caregiving behavioral system that we can access and animate through practice. With self-compassion, we can learn how to reparent ourselves in ways we may have never received. All of the insecure styles will benefit from practicing self-attunement and learning how to truly self-regulate and self-soothe, rather than turning to distraction, deflection, or avoidance. There can be a healing effect of being with discomfort or contacting pain or pleasure without collapsing or disconnecting that can allow people to access their own inner safe haven and secure base. Each of the insecure attachment styles also have some specific ways that they can further grow specific to that style. Ways that each of the insecure attachment styles can focus on growth are, so for preoccupied, focus on strengthening your sense of self. You can begin to do this through identifying your own values, needs, likes, and dislikes. What makes you tick? What are your dreams, talents, callings, and purposes? Exploring personality tests like the Enneagram or Myers-Briggs, as well as knowing your love languages, can also support this process. Boundaries, boundaries, and boundaries. The anxious style tends to have more porous boundaries regarding input, where other people are defining you, as well as more porous boundaries on the output, where you are inserting yourself too far into another person's emotional, physical, or mental space. Creating more distinct but not rigid boundaries is important for learning how to stay in your own skin while being connected to others, rather than leaving yourself behind to be with others. Also, be aware of not letting people occupy more of your internal space than you are. Recognize when you are abandoning yourself and learn techniques to come back into your own body and your own internal world. Body-based meditations and awareness practices can support you being better able to inhabit your own body. When co-regulating with partners, make sure that it is reciprocal and that you are not either over-caretaking at the expense of yourself or asking them to take care of you without regard for themselves. Work on being able to receive love. Even though someone with a preoccupied attachment style is more likely to complain that they are not getting enough love or attention, when it is given, they often struggle with how to really let it in and receive it. What obstacles or defensive mechanisms arise when love, connection, or nourishment is actually being offered to you? Learn techniques to ground and work with your anxiety instead of projecting it onto others or directing your anxiety into the relational space. The dismissive style. Needing support does not mean that you are weak, needy, or less than. People with this style can carry a lot of toxic shame about needing others or having any needs at all. Can you begin to accept that wanting support or attention from others is all right, even healthy, and not a negative reflection on your abilities, competence, or independence? I invite you to allow the fullness of your humanness. With people who are safe, begin to take the risk of revealing and sharing more of yourself so that people can get a glimpse into your internal world. This could take the form of relaxing some of your more rigid boundaries and letting more of yourself out. Also work on letting people in more. Let people have an impact on how you feel, or allow their experiences, needs, opinions, or feedback to impact your perspective. Work with transforming your self-reliant parts through relying more on or leaning into your partners for support, nourishment, and connection. It's okay to start with small requests. I almost had a panic attack the first time I asked my partner to pick up a yogurt for me on the way over to my house. To me, this seemed like an unreasonable ask, even though he was the one who asked me if I needed anything from the store he was already stopping at. Wake up your body. Often people with a dismissive style exist primarily in their heads, being cut off from the neck down. Exploring movement practices, body-based meditations, and awareness practices can help you wake up your body and begin to allow and tolerate a whole range of sensations and feelings. Learn how to articulate your feelings and needs. This is easier said than done, since this is a developmental capacity that you have to learn and grow, not just an easy behavioral shift or a switch that you can just turn on. Please be patient with yourself. Fearful avoidant. People with this style either experience alternating aspects of the dismissive and preoccupied styles, or both can occur simultaneously. So try some or all of the above suggestions for both the preoccupied and the dismissive styles that feels relevant to you. In addition to the above suggestions, you can also focus on building an internal sense of safety where you have a bodily felt sense that you are safe and that you can relax, even if it's just with yourself at first. When there has been trauma, this usually requires the support of a professional. Build an inner sense of protection. Doing inner work can support you in identifying the parts of you that can protect you and are not harmful to you or others. It can also be helpful to invite these protective parts to become more central to your daily experience. Remembering a person or a time when you felt protected, and allowing that memory to come alive in your body can support you in having a tangible somatic experience of protection that you can access when you need it. Even when people have had parents who were harmful or not protective, there is usually someone we can identify as having felt a sense of protection with, whether it was another relative, a teacher, or someone in our community. If you are truly unable to access any memories, people, or times when you felt protected, explore the mythical, fictional, or spiritual realms, where there might be a character that you resonate with or a spiritual and archetypal energy that you can associate protection with. Learn about the signs of being in an abusive relationship, as well as the signs and signals that someone is gaslighting, manipulating, or acting in narcissistic ways. People functioning in this style can unintentionally normalize what is abusive and unhealthy, and so need help in being able to explicitly distinguish what is healthy and unhealthy, what is abusive or caring, and what is addictive or genuine. Surround yourself with people who truly mean well, who are more securely attached, and who want to be a support for you in your healing process. Some questions to consider. What does self-attunement look like for you? In what ways do you auto-regulate or try to use others to regulate so that you don't have to self-regulate? What would self-regulation look like for you? How would you like to increase your self-attunement and self-regulation? What is your relationship with your inner nurturer like? And how can this part of you become more front and center in your relationship with yourself? Here are some things to try and to experiment with for self-attunement. Spend quiet time by yourself. Practice mindfulness or breath-based exercises that help you tune into your body, heart, and mind. Try self-compassion meditations. Experiment with journaling. Try self-hypnosis techniques. Learn self-empathy practices that can help you identify your feelings and needs and give yourself what you need as best as you can. Figure out what different kinds of sensory input, such as sights, smells, sounds, touches, or tastes, are calming or irritating to you, and have certain smells or types of music available for when you are needing some self-support. Develop a relationship with your inner nurturer, and if needed, work with a practitioner to support you in this process. R, rituals and routines for a secure self. Any secure relationship with yourself will include the rituals and routines that support you in your self-care and sanity. If we refer back to early childhood, it is easy to see how children thrive when there is enough structure and predictable routine for the different needs of their bodies and the various transitions within a day. As adults, this does not change. There are natural rhythms to our cycles of sleeping, eating, resting, and having sex that suffer when ignored. Both men and women have hormonal cycles that fluctuate, impacting our mood, mental acuity, how sensitive we feel, and how short or long our fuse for anger and frustration will be. Secure attachment with self includes knowing your inner rhythms, biological, emotional, and mental, and figuring out what routines and daily rituals best support you to be in alignment with your own needs and pacing. Larger, more intentional or ceremonial rituals also play an important part in your relationship with yourself. Rituals and rites of passage that are intended to initiate us into higher aspects of self or mature us into adulthood are all but lost in our Western culture, and the few that remain may be confirmation of faith, the bar of bat mitzvah, marriage, sweet 16 or quinceañera, high school or college graduation. Most of those have been co-opted and commercialized so as to divest them from their traditional purpose, which was a literal change of consciousness for which the people involved had been physically, mentally, and emotionally prepared, leaving only a vestigial symbolic importance. The loss of the impact of such culturally approved rites of passage means that the millennia-old practice of having a ritual-based matrix in place to assist us with adjusting to life events and the accompanying change of consciousness required to accommodate those events is often no longer available to us. The traditional ashrama system in Hinduism, for example, specifies that after having been a student and a householder and fulfilling one's earthly responsibilities in the culture, a person should undergo the ritual of sannyasa, which is the renunciation of worldly affairs, and shift consciousness towards preparation for giving up their body at the time of death. Without such a custom, we are often left to deal with the anxiety and stress of end-of-life issues without a supportive community or a clearly understood cultural context that contributes to our psychic security. The modern psychedelic renaissance, when Westerners travel to South and Central America and partake in ayahuasca rituals for the purpose of healing and self-discovery, also underscores the lack of such important rituals in our own cultural milieu, while simultaneously demonstrating how far people will go to restore the much-needed self-awareness such rituals potentially provide. When examining the apparent emptiness of much sacramental or ritual activity in the West and its lack of ability in modern times to alter the consciousness of the person undergoing it, many philosophers like Carl Jung and Terence McKenna, among others, have noted that over time, sacraments have become merely symbolic. Fortunately, nothing stops us from revitalizing older rituals or even creating new ones to assist us with living successfully and happily in the world we inhabit. When focusing on establishing a more secure relationship with yourself, one of the most influential routines we can implement is what I refer to as self-alignment practices. When we start to clear away the debris of our insecure attachment styles, we reveal a secure self that can be cultivated and aligned with. Many of us already have a sense of the parts of us that we might refer to as our better self or higher self, or what I refer to as my secure self or aligned self. This is the part of me that is aligned with my better skills, values, visions, and morals. When we actively engage in practices that bring these parts of us to the forefront, we are rewiring ourselves to resonate more easily with a self that is more peaceful, joyful, loving, and accepting. If we give fuel to a negative self in the form of constant or obsessive mental reinforcement of that version of ourselves, then we strengthen that construct. But it also stands to reason that the opposite is true. If we live in alignment with our most secure, loving, and happy self and practice living through the lens of the qualities about us that are remarkable, then we stabilize that construct until that is who we will eventually become. So here are some questions to consider around routines and rituals. What routines and rituals do you have that support you in your well-being and self-care? What routines and rituals do you need to add into your day or week that would even better support you in your well-being and self-care? Are there larger rituals or rites of passage that you would like to experience? What practices do you already do that align with your better or secure self, big or small? What practices could you take on to align yourself with the secure you? Things to try and experiment with. If you could design your ideal day or week based on your natural rhythms of sleeping, eating, resting, connecting, or having sex, what would that look like? Experiment with adjusting some of your day or week to better accommodate these preferences. Imagine your ideal day or week that includes self-care activities and rituals that support you in secure functioning with yourself. Start to add some of these routines to your daily or weekly activities, even if you start with something as small as 5 minutes a day. Plan larger rituals or rites of passage that you think might assist you in your journey. A quick internet search may give you some ideas. There are also a variety of group ritualistic practices available in many places, ranging from silent retreats to group shamanic drumming. Find one you think would be helpful and just go experiment. Check out Dr. Daniel P. Brown's Ideal Parent Figure Exercise, which can support you in rewiring your past and feeling more secure in the present. Give definition to your secure self. What does this part of you look like? How does this part of you behave? What values and principles guide this part of you? Explore different techniques and practices to support you in aligning with your more secure self. T, turning towards yourself after inner conflict and doing trigger management. In the previous chapter, the T in heart was about turning towards each other after conflict, focusing on how we repair with our partners when there have been disconnections, fights, or misunderstandings. Repairing with ourself is also essential. How we treat ourselves when we have made a mistake, when there is an internal battle between different parts of ourselves, or when we have fallen short of our own standards, ethics, or expectations, is imperative in building a strong, inner, secure foundation. In the section on Express Delight with Yourself, I have already spoken about the importance of working with one's inner critic, which is equally relevant here as well. When your inner critic is beating you up, bullying you, or injecting self-doubt into your consciousness, knowing how to work with this part of you and reclaim your power from it is enormously helpful. Left unchecked, our inner critic can further feed cycles of attachment anxiety and avoidance that can be destructive and paralyzing. One important aspect in working with your inner critic and being able to reduce the impact of its harsh ways is learning how to translate its message. When we engage in dialogue with this part of us and inquire into why it is so persistent, more times than not, we find that it is trying to protect us from harm, from looking bad, from being disliked, or from failing in some way. Stated more positively, this part of us is usually trying to keep us safe and to assure us that we are getting some form of love, acceptance, or social inclusion. The irony here is that even though its intention is positive at its core, its methods of self-scolding, shooting, or shaming are seriously counterproductive to the cause. However, when we are able to identify the positive and protective intention that our inner critic has for us, we can gain the power to translate its intention. Let's look at an example. When I hear my inner critic say that bringing up that I'm hurt by something to my partner is petty of me and that I'm being overly sensitive or too needy, I can get curious about what this part of me is trying to actually do. In this case, my inner critic is trying to keep me from getting further hurt based on the fear that if I reveal myself, I won't be cared for and listened to in the way I need, and I will ultimately lose the relationship for having needs. Yes, this is a history of neglect speaking here. So at that moment, if I am mindful of it, I can first give myself what I need, which is the acknowledgement and acceptance of what I'm feeling, and then some self-care. I am able to translate the inner critic and then be my own safe haven through some self-connection and soothing. This then allows me to approach my partner from a position of advocating for my needs rather than from the voice of the inner critic. Dick Schwartz, the developer of the internal family systems model, makes an important distinction that in relationships, we can speak for our parts, but should be careful not to speak from them. When I speak directly from my inner critic, I am likely to be blaming of my partner or myself, which pushes us further apart. If I am able to speak for the part of me that has been hurt, more possibility opens up for both of us to be understood and get our needs met. Initially, doing the work of translating our inner critic takes diligence. The inner critic is usually a persistent old habit that is well established in the neural networks of our brain. So expecting change overnight is not realistic. But identifying the inner critic's larger intention, not believing what it says as completely true, and translating its voice over and over again eventually pays off, and it is well worth the effort, I promise you. Managing triggers is another important component of creating secure attachment with yourself. Triggers are events that happen in the present and activate painful or traumatic experiences from the past that have some resemblance of what's happening in the present moment. When this happens, it's extremely difficult to tease apart what we are reacting to in this moment that is real and legitimate, and what is the past stuff that's coloring our interpretation and our current reactivity. Millions of years of evolution have wired into us a stress response that is meant to keep us alive in life-threatening situations. When we feel threatened, our primitive reptilian brain and our emotional mammalian brain systems fire up to either fight and defend ourselves, flee and quickly escape, freeze and play dead, or appease and submit. This has been a very necessary system to help us first detect if our environment is safe or dangerous, and then to instantaneously react accordingly. But interestingly, our brains can't distinguish between a physical threat to our life and an emotional or mental threat to our ego, our identity, or worldview. So when we think we've made a mistake, when someone challenges our worldview, or when we presume that someone is going to judge or reject us, we can get triggered into the fight, flight, freeze, appease response. In today's world, it's not a ferocious animal that poses a threat, but your partner on the couch texting with someone else, or your date being 20 minutes late. But your body can respond in the same way as if your life were threatened. Our bodies were not designed for the daily stressors of modern life or to be triggered on a regular basis. So it's important to our mental and physical health that we learn to manage triggers. I've come to see trigger management as a basic life skill that we all need for the health and success of any relationship, whether with a family member, friend, coworker, parent, child, or romantic partner. Then I started to work with non-monogamous people, and I transitioned to being polyamorous myself. And understanding our triggers and knowing how to diffuse our reactivity became even more relevant. In non-monogamy, we need more skills around our triggers because as the number of people increases, the constellation of intimate relationships complexifies. For many, this relational complexity can be very beautiful and rich. It can feed those of us who want deeper community and tribe. But it can also bring many more opportunities for our triggers to get activated with each different lover, metamor, and each new family member or friend of your partner that comes along. In non-monogamy, we can also get completely blindsided with triggers that we did not even know that we had, triggers that would have never shown up within the context of monogamy. That said, my experience has taught me that our triggers can be a gift. Of course, it never feels like a gift in the moment of being triggered, but we can approach, if we approach our triggers with curiosity and learn to shift into being responsive instead of acting from knee-jerk reactivity, our triggers become an amazing opportunity to strengthen and deepen our relationships with ourselves and with our partners. Just as how we want to speak for our parts instead of directly from them, we also want to learn how to respond to our triggers instead of reacting from them. Understanding and inquiring into your triggers can be a powerful way to heal past pain and transform outdated beliefs or stories that you might still be stuck in. Working with your triggers can free you up to live your life and conduct your relationships based on your preferred expressions of self, living from love, connection, and choice instead of automatic reactions. So, some questions to consider. How do you treat yourself when you make a mistake or fall short of your own standards and expectations? How do you respond to yourself when you have an inner conflict? How would you like to treat yourself differently? What would become possible if you did this? How frequently are you getting triggered, and how does this impact you? What could you do to better manage your triggers, both preventively and during an actual trigger? Some things to try and experiment with. When your inner critic arises, try engaging in dialogue with it instead of just believing it or trying to push it away. Ask what it wants for you and if it is trying to protect you in any way. You can do this verbally, internally, or in writing. Keep engaging with it until you get a positive intention that it is holding for you. Once you have this positive intention, you can then experiment with translating the inner critic anytime it arises again. Seek support through books, programs, training, or with a professional to work with your inner critic and to manage your triggers. No matter how triggered, anxious, or out of control you feel, it's important to know that you can manage your arousal system and calm yourself. Mindful deep belly breathing, even just for 60 seconds, is an effective way to decrease heightened arousal and return your body into a state of homeostasis. Experiment with cognitive reappraisal or cognitive reframing techniques to reinterpret a situation and change your emotional response to it. For example, if you haven't heard from a partner for an unusual amount of time, instead of thinking that they are uninterested in you or pulling away, you might instead wonder if they are busy doing something important or whether their phone battery died. Or if you are struggling with a partner or metamor, you can try to see the situation from their point of view and consider how they may also be struggling in this situation. Check out Deirdre Fay's workbook, Becoming Safely Embodied, a skills-based approach to working with trauma and dissociation. Check out Bonnie Weiss and Jay Early's book, Freedom from Your Inner Critic, a Self-Therapy Approach. In this chapter, we have covered how to create earned secure attachment and how to apply the heart of being polysecure to yourself. Changing deeply ingrained habits and beliefs is not easy or instantaneous, but it is possible. Doing this kind of work can be life-changing and well worth the effort. However, there is a paradox in this process of working with our attachment. Some people might advise you to first create a secure attachment with yourself before you can have secure relationships with others. Or they might say that you need to experience secure attachment with others before you can have it with yourself. When we are talking about adults, I believe that both can be true. What you've gone through both as a child and as an adult, how pain-free or painful your non-monogamy journey has been, and where you are in your personal growth process will dictate what's best for you. Some of us need to take a pause on dating and turn inward to heal, deconstruct, and rebuild ourselves. This can allow us to bring forward a more fortified and healthy self that is able to relate in more secure ways with others. Others may need to first have enough positive experiences where we feel seen, loved, and met before embarking on inner work. These experiences can build a certain outer relational security that then enables us to have enough self-worth, courage, and capacity to look inward. These processes can alternate back and forth, or can also occur simultaneously, where we are both in relationships that are healing and supportive to us and at the same time doing inner attachment work as well. Whichever of the polysecure heart's path is for you, please allow it to unfold in the ways that work best and make the most sense for you and your relationships, knowing that it will probably be more circuitous than linear.